From the Sky News Centre at 5, Theresa May wants the UK to remain a member of the single market for 2 years after Brexit to allow a smooth transition. The Prime Minister's set out her plans during a speech in Florence. She also said the UK needs its own bespoke trade deal with the EU, a point Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson agrees with.
She made it very, very clear. We don't mean the relationship like Norway, receiving laws, but not being able to change them or to vote on them. We're going to be able to do our own thing, but also to work positively together on defence, on security.
But former UKIP leader Nigel Farage has accused the PM of lacking the desire or vision to be the leader the UK needs through Brexit. Meanwhile, the EU's lead on talks, Michel Barnier, has said Mrs May's speech needs to be translated into negotiating positions to make meaningful progress. Transport for London's told Uber it's not fit and proper to hold a licence to operate in the city. The taxi app's current one expires a week tomorrow, affecting its 40,000 drivers and over 3 million customers. The US-based firm's to appeal the decision, which the regulator says was based on concerns about security and public safety. Fred Jones from Uber disputes that.
Safety has been integral to our service since we launched in London over 5.5 years ago. All our drivers are licensed by Transport for London, and they've been through the same enhanced background checks as London black cab drivers.
A man's appeared in court charged over last week's terror attack at Parsons Green tube station in West London. 18-year-old Ahmed Hassan is accused of attempted murder and using an explosive device. Donald Trump has hit back after the North Korean leader called him deranged in a statement. The US president responded with a tweet saying Kim Jong-un is obviously a madman who will be tested like never before. And Morrisons and Sainsbury's have followed Asda in cutting fuel prices. Costs increased recently following Hurricane Harvey, which disrupted oil refineries in Texas. That's the latest. I'm Annie Joyce.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. After the 6 o'clock news, General Assembly of the United Nations this week, with world leaders setting out their stalls. We hear tonight from US President Donald Trump, our own Theresa May, and Iran's President Rouhani. What did he have to say? We didn't hear that on the news at 10. And Venezuela plays host to a Latin American summit to celebrate 200 years since Simón Bolívar began to come to prominence. He was a Creole, directly descended from Spanish aristocracy, but ended up breaking the Spanish grip on the entire continent, pretty much. Nowadays, it's Miami-based Southcom, not the Spanish, that the South Americans have to worry about. And talking of Madrid, King Juan Carlos is struggling to stop independence referenda by both the Basques and the Catalans now, who are becoming ever more determined to break away from an increasingly fascist-looking Spanish government. Also on the upside, the Fair World Project breaking the grip of money on our lives and the coercion that comes with it. Cooperative Party and Occupy London activist John Courtenage on why there won't be any change for us or the planet until we identify deliberate shackles of the money system and get around a simple plan of how it can work in everyone's best interests. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 14 Celsius and rainy. This weekend, temperatures around 21 Celsius, pretty warm actually. Sunny spells tomorrow, but mainly cloudy on Sunday. So, forget the shopping, go out on Saturday and enjoy the weather. Next week, highs of 21 Celsius, plenty of sunny spells, but also showers next week. Next weekend, that's the 30th of September and the 1st of October, highs, well, lows, highs down 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So it's the third time now that Bristol's Labour Mayor Marvin Rees has pulled out of this show at the last minute. He hasn't faced the music once, despite scores of invites and phone calls since he was elected over 16 months ago. We have lots to talk about, not least of which is more of our money wasted with the departure of a second chief executive, and particularly unimaginative response to central government cuts, the biggest library closure programme in the country. One does wonder, what's the point of voting Labour if all we get is far worse cuts than under independent George Ferguson? As well as the prospect of forcing people with no money to pay his council tax or go to jail. Anyway, his office say he's got important meetings this evening, though they wouldn't elaborate, and nor why they left it till just a couple of days before to let me know. But we have found out that he's actually coming to Eastern Community Centre to have a meeting with some Labour activists. I'm surprised that that's not something that could have waited half an hour until 6 o'clock, where he's meeting just outside this door, a few yards away from this studio. Funnily enough, but anyway, we've got better than that. We've got from the Lib Dems, Tim Kent from Whitchurch Park. Tim Kent, hi Tim, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening. I'm not too sure anyone else would agree I was better than that.
Well, what we've done is with the activists outside, we've said it, when Marvin arrives, do let him know he can pop in any time he likes, just even if it's just for a couple of minutes to answer some questions and talk with us. But anyway, we'll see if he does. I'm not holding my breath. Tim, one of the reasons I wanted so much to talk to Marvin, obviously, you know, the mayor is an important person to have on a programme like this, and George Ferguson was pretty ready to come on generally, especially when there's something going on. But we've got some pretty horrible changes been going on at the City Council. Not only is this this so-called consultation going through to get people with no money at all to pay council tax or face jail, but we've also had some big changes amongst the actual council staff, that is the full-timers, haven't we?
That's correct. I mean, we've just had consultations on library cuts, other neighbourhood cuts, also about the council tax rebate system, which we'll see the poorest having to pay council tax. And then still to come, actually, is another consultation we're getting in October, which will be about tens of millions of pounds more of cuts. And as you pointed out, we've also been losing some senior staff, including the chief executive, over the summer.
Now, one of the controversial things about that is that we've had two now. Could you just remind us who those two chief executives were since George?
Well, we had Nicola Yates when he first came in. Actually, we've had at least three, because we had a temporary chief executive after Nicola, whose name I can't remember at all. And then we've had Anna, who's just left. And she had originally turned up to be a temporary finance officer to replace a finance officer we also lost at the time. So we've got through three chief executives in a year so far.
But Anna was brought in February, wasn't she? And there was quite a lot of controversy around the appointment because the minutes weren't kept at the Human Resources Committee and various other problems. For example, one of the Labour members of Human Resources initially said that Anna wasn't going to be suitable. But after a couple of days, she came back and changed her mind. She said, oh, yes, Anna would be really good. And then she gets herself a place on the cabinet, apparently, according to Gary.
Your sources are better than mine, but what I can say is I do know that there were some great concerns about the appointment process. In fact, a statement was made at full council in public by some of the members who are part of that panel to say they were concerned that I understand some of the key issues were that that some of those people on the panel had not actually been trained, which is concerning because it is a very major appointment. It's the highest paying appointment in the council. And secondly, the other sort of key concern is I think the appointment was originally made with no vote of the committee, which itself would have been a real problem. I understand that now HR are now working to ensure those problems are resolved and they do not repeat those problems.
Very peculiar situation. And also, of course, when you get it wrong, as has happened, now she's just left a couple of weeks ago, there's a financial penalty to pay and also a gap. What is happening now? Are we going to have a replacement chief executive?
Well, that's a good question. There is a gap. And also, of course, when you get a new leader in, they put in place what they want to be done. They set that in place. That can take years to achieve. And of course, the council's all set down one path and now has been left in chaos. Will we have a new chief executive? Well, that is the debate which is on. I guess the only person who can answer that is the mayor, Marvin. But some people are wondering whether or not a new chief executive will be appointed. I mean, it is obviously a very expensive post. Money could be saved. Having said that, Bristol City Council is an organisation of around 6,000 staff and a £1 billion budget. The idea that you won't have someone leading that is I think, quite concerning.
So if Nicola or Anna aren't leading the staff of the City Council, who will?
Well, at the moment, as far as I'm aware, one of the senior officers is acting up. But I've got to say, I have not myself received an email telling me who the current acting up chief executive is. So it is the mayor. But of course, until a few days ago, the mayor was away in New York.
Also, we had a fairly big demonstration. The Evening Post say 8,000. People I've spoken to say more like 3,000 or 5,000 people turned up outside the council house, City Hall nowadays, supposedly, on College Green, to listen to the mayor and others talking about how terrible the cuts were, although there doesn't seem to be necessarily much of a solution. One of the things that Marvin said, and it would be lovely to have him sitting here now to answer this, is that he was going to take this message to central government. The only trouble was, and of course he took several senior councillors and MPs with him to London to talk to central government, presumably at city council expenses, and then found that there wasn't anyone, no one was prepared to talk to him. So that was a bit of a wild goose chase. Nothing happened at all. And yet, are Bristol City Council taxpayers paying for trips like that? And not only that, cancelled a full council meeting.
Yeah, it does seem like a lot of effort was put into the march, but not as much effort was put into the meeting with government to follow that march up. From what I understand is there's a bit of confusion, but it seems like several government ministries have said they never actually even received an invite in the first place. Whether they were someone or not, it does seem remarkable that you book trains, you go all the way to London to meet with government ministers, but nobody's actually got one confirmed as attending. As you say, we did cancel a full council meeting based on what we were told, which was that Marvin and his cabinet were going to London to meet with ministers. And we said, well, based on that, clearly that is the priority. You know, there is no doubt it is a government cuts in funding along with pressures on our budget, demographic social changes within our population, which are causing the big financial crisis in councils.
Well, there's another problem, and that is when you're losing people like chief executives, service directors, senior managers from council staff, you're also having to pay people to come in on a weekly basis, often having to pay them a lot more than you would if you gave them a proper contract. It does seem like this mess is actually costing us council taxpayers quite a lot of money.
And I mean, don't forget the previous chief executive was paid a large amount of money to leave. And that is money that could
be talking about hundreds of thousands
services.
Of pounds, aren't we?
I believe it was a few hundred thousand pounds, yes.
Also, what about this library closure programme? There's some people looking at Bristol and saying, can this be real? Because it's by far the biggest library closure programme in the country. And yet we've elected a Labour mayor to keep those libraries open. The opposite seems to be happening. Is this just a ploy, do you think, to get people worried, to make people realise just how nasty these central government cuts could be? Or are they really going to close these libraries? And are there any alternatives to Marvin's plan?
Well, it's my understanding that this is a real proposal. In fact, the original proposal, which was accidentally leaked out, was to close every single library bar one, because the report looking at the impact of this was leaked to councillors. But of course, then the actual proposal was never brought forward. So the original plan was to close 26, 27 libraries. This has now been reduced to 17. It looks like it's a real proposal, but since publishing, we have been told by the administration that they will consider other suggestions. So that's what we've made. We've made an alternative suggestion which says you can save money, You can keep libraries open, but it will take longer to do this. Now, this is part of the problem. They are rushing into cuts rather than long-term looking at services. Are there alternative models for delivery which could work in this city?
Well, so has Marvin looked at the Conservative plans, which actually mean less library cuts? Or the local Conservative Party has put forward plans saying, look, you don't need to make all these cuts to libraries.
Well, we've put forward a plan. We've put forward a plan as part of the consultation.
So that's the Lib Dems as well?
What we have said is that you can form a charitable company. This has been done in several other councils, and actually it's worked very well. But you can't rush into this. For this to work, it does take 18 months, 2 years. It takes a lot of planning. Obviously, we still want a professionally led library service, and that's a key thing. But it will be bringing in volunteers then to help deliver that on the ground day to day. So volunteers working alongside professional librarians. And we believe that means that, in fact, we can increase income into our libraries and save money and keep branches open. That's been the evidence from several other councils who've done this, but you've got to put the effort in.
Now, looking at the cuts programme that Marvin's put forward, it does actually look as if he's cutting more earlier in that programme than he really needs to. And another thing I'd love to have asked him is, why are you deciding to do that? Surely, you know, why not take George Ferguson's approach, which is to kick the can down the road when it comes to cuts as much as possible?
Well, a cynic would point out that you make cuts early so they forget by election time. I would like to think that it's more that they're trying to prepare for worse cuts to come. Having said that, there are other options. And if you do plan these things out, some cuts can be avoided. Not everything. We've got to be honest and realistic with people. Some cuts will have to be made, no doubt about that. You know, the pressure on councils' budgets are phenomenal. And it's not just about cuts. It's also an increase in costs that we find, particularly in the area of elderly care. And it's that constant pressure on our budget there where we don't receive enough funding from government to account for the increase in services we have to provide.
So is this austerity a disaster?
Well, I think a big question is for everybody is, when is austerity going to end?
It started with the Lib Dems, didn't it, coalition with the Tories?
Well, I don't like to take it away from it. It actually started with Labour under Gordon Brown, austerity. So, in fact, we've been in austerity now for, I think, 9, close to 10 years.
Well, you can say that. I couldn't possibly comment. Well, but as far as I know, most of the cuts started when the Conservatives got in coalition with the Lib Dems, like they're now in coalition with the, unofficially, with the DUP. But it is the Lib Dems, isn't it, Tim?
Well,
you've got to admit
that. Well, the pay freeze for public sector staff, the cuts to local government budgets all began about 10 years ago. It was the first thing to get hit. And this is, I think, where we're coming from now. What we're saying to government is, actually, we've delivered substantial savings. Bristol City Council has actually delivered £200 million worth of savings over the last 10 years. So what we need to now say to government is, to be honest, you guys haven't delivered those savings in your departments. You can't keep hitting local government. And so I think the message has to be from all politicians of whatever party to central government, this now has to end. We have to have funding of services, or otherwise the only thing left we will be funding is elderly care. And that means we will have to close down every other service. It will be schools and elderly care. And that will be it.
Martin, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, you are a Labour Party member. Does it rather make you despair to see the cuts being front-loaded? In other words, cutting more than necessary now to give Marvin maybe a better chance of winning the next local election and becoming mayor again?
Well, I don't really know all the detail about this, and therefore I haven't got a strong opinion.
One of the most important details is that we do have by far the biggest library closure programme in the country right now, and there's no necessarily any need for even the Conservatives. Bristol are protesting, saying you don't need to close all these libraries.
Well, one of the things I would suggest is you close libraries in Conservative wards because they want cuts. They're the ones at national level that want cuts. Maybe we should actually get nasty and start cutting libraries.
But people voted Labour, didn't they? Don't you think this is actually bad for the Labour Party?
Well, I'm just saying, what Marvin could do, as I've just suggested, is close libraries in Conservative voting wards.
He's not going to do that
because Conservatives are in the administration. But when you point out that we've got elderly care to point out, I use the library a lot. I'm very much a library user. I've used the library for years and years and years. It's very, very, very important to me. But only 6% of people in this city, in general, use libraries. And if we've got to cut, and of course I would argue that we don't have to cut. We didn't have to cut in 2010. We don't have to cut now.
But we're getting,
austerity was always wrong.
What we're getting is far worse cuts than we got under George Ferguson.
Well, that's because the screw is tightening, I would suggest to you, Tony. Now, you can kick the can down the road, but then you've got to pick it up again. That's what we've been doing ever since the crash in 2008.
But the Conservatives here are saying we do not need to cut all these libraries. We could cut maybe half of them.
Because they don't want the libraries cut in their wards. I'm sure they don't. But we've got to pay for elderly care, as has just been pointed out. Now, in actual fact, we ought to, if you were going to take a partisan point of view, you would cut all social services other than statutory social services in Tory voting wards. In the posh parts of the city, why should we provide libraries for wealthy people if we're going to have cuts?
Well, we are going to have cuts. Anyway, what do you make of that, Tim?
I was just thinking about the map. I'm fairly certain, actually, they're proposing to close virtually every library in the Tory wards. But that is because they are proposing to close most of the libraries. And even those, of course, that will remain open will mostly see their hours reduced as well. So, take the party politics out of this. There are possible other solutions that we can deliver which will potentially save money. And this also goes for parks as well and other services.
Can you just get a bit of detail on that, Tim?
Yeah. So the option we put forward is the idea of a mutualisation. So basically setting up a charitable company, which would then be run by the professional librarians. They would take over the buildings. They would take over the services. They'd have a contract with the council to deliver those library services. And then they can raise additional money from the private sector, sponsorship. And also, it does have to be said, a lot of voluntary staff to help keep those libraries open, working under professional librarians. There would always be a professional librarian involved. Now, some councils have done this. Devon, Suffolk, York, as the best recent examples. And they've done it very successfully. But it's not something you can do quickly if you want it to work. It does take really up to 2 years of planning to get in place to work. And then what you can do is keep more libraries open, keep more librarians employed, and have a better service. And what they have found is that the private sector is more willing to work with them because they're not the council. That's not a good thing for the council to hear, that people don't want to work with us, but it's the truth. So that being the case. Now, this would never be actually my personal preference. Personally, I think the library should be provided by the local council. It should be a core service. But given the finances we face, we've been asked to think out of the box. So that's what we propose. So we hope the mayor may adopt this. It's not news to him. He's aware of this option. And for some reason, it was excluded from the consultation. We don't understand why. So we're raising it again in hopes that him and his cabinet member, Councillor Craig, will seriously consider this.
Martin, why do you think Marvin isn't listening?
Well, you'd have to ask Marvin, wouldn't you? I mean, I don't know.
Do you want to run outside and ask him?
No, I don't want to do that, Tony. Whatever we do, the problem is that a lot of the cuts have been loaded onto local government because central government, as you say, finds it difficult to cut its own budgets. So they load it onto local government so they can just pass the buck. And of course, at the end of the day, providing care for elderly people and sick people is fundamental, and providing schooling is fundamental.
But what about for people who need internet
access? There are statutory things you have to do.
What about for people that need internet access, don't have internet access at home, can't afford internet access at home? The library is the only place they can do a lot of things that they have to do now.
Well, what I would suggest,
they have to do in the library.
What I would suggest, Tony, is we need to change the central government and change the policy of cutting local government budgets.
But that ain't happening anytime soon, is it?
Well, in that case, we've got to cut something then, Tony. What do you suggest?
Well, I don't necessarily suggest we do the biggest library cuts proposal. I mean, we've just heard from the Conservatives and from Tim here that there are alternatives to cutting all these libraries. So anyway,
well, let's see.
Yeah, let's also move on now to talk about the charging today of. I think it's a man has been charged, that's right, with the Parsons Green tube in big inverted commas bombing. Ahmed Hassan, who's 18 years old, has been charged. The only problem here is that there seems to have been quite a lot of, I mean, there's question marks over as to whether he really is a terrorist, in big inverted commas. The Metropolitan Police very quickly, after the incident last Friday, this time last week, said it was a terrorist incident, and that was around about an hour and a half after it happened. And yet, if you look at the articles to do with the attack, first of all, it's not entirely clear whether this was really a bomb, so to speak. It was a bucket, a plastic bucket, which had some chemical in it, which caught fire with fairy lights in it. But it certainly didn't seem to be an explosion, according to eyewitnesses. And one of those eyewitnesses, by the name of Chris Wildish, went on live literally just after the incident onto the Nikki Campbell show on Radio 5. So let's just have a listen to one of the eyewitnesses who was, like, literally within half an hour of the incident happening last Friday, was able to tell everybody around the country on 5 Live what he'd seen.
We've got another witness to talk to now. It's 9:41, and here's Chris. Yeah, tell us about your experience, Chris. Thanks for getting in touch.
Hi. Good morning. I was on the carriage just beyond the one where the device was. And there was just a loud kind of thwomp noise, not a bang, more a thumping noise. And then I didn't see a fireball. And then two things happened, a very strong acrid chemical smell and then a stampede. The stampede was probably scarier than anything else, because you see what happens when a pack takes off. People getting knocked over, people getting trampled. Just trying to get away, and I guess them continuing down through the carriages. But yes, there were one lady's child was left in his pushchair. She had to go back in and get the child out of the pushchair. And scenes of literally glasses, phones, newspapers, shoes, bags discarded as people headed up the train.
Just to clarify from the start of this, the explosion or whatever it was took place when the train was in the station.
We had just pulled into the station, and, you know, when you kind of, the train comes to a stop and you're waiting for the doors to open, then at that kind of split second, it went off. So as we pulled into Parsons Green, the train was stopped, and whoop, off it went. I saw the device because I was relatively close to it. It's a white bucket. It looks like a... I'd call it a builder's bucket, for want of a better description, in a little bag or something like that. It had flames were still coming out of it when I saw it, quite low-level flames, and a lot of wires hanging out of it. So I can only assume that it was done on purpose. There was a young girl, a young schoolgirl, who was pretty hysterical trying to get her phone so she could phone her mother, and you could step back onto the train. You know, the doors were open. So I walked in. I did two things, walked in and try to find her phone for her, which unfortunately we couldn't. And the second thing was brought a lady's pushchair out of the train. So it was standing in the corner of the rearmost, against the door of the rearmost carriage. I saw the device, yes. Yes, I did see it. A lot of people stood around on the platform because, A, it was pretty congested, so getting off was more difficult. Some people knew what was going on, but others, it was, you know, is this just an electrical fault? You're not 100% sure what's going on. But people started moving towards the door, and the emergency services were superb. They were there, they were in, and they took control immediately. And we were then funneled out of the station and onto the road outside to wait for the police to give our contact details. And then the guy started arriving with guns. And, you know, I've got to say, the emergency services were totally in control and absolutely fantastic. So it was pretty full, certainly rush hour full. And it was just, as it is, it's a banal commute as you head into work, and the next thing, all hell breaks loose. I think what we have to be thankful for, and obviously I don't know what the device is or any of it. If it had been a big one, a lot of people would have got hurt. A lot more people certainly would have got hurt than, as I say, it was more a whomping sound than a bang.
Martin, that's Chris Wildish saying more a whomping sound than a bang. Also, if you have a look at the pictures of the carriage, really no damage to the tube at all.
No, I mean, I saw the video of the bomb, so-called, which had obviously been taken by somebody on a mobile phone. I think it's interesting hearing what he'd said, because I was wondering, well, why are people wandering around taking mobile phone pictures? But if they couldn't get off the platform, then that would explain why they're hanging around taking pictures.
They're actually, as he was saying, they're going back onto the train to see if they could find stuff after everyone had run off, then going back on to try and retrieve things like a pushchair, apparently with a baby in it.
Yeah. Well, like all of these incidents, where it takes a while for you know all the various strands of what's happened to be put together, and no everybody to try and work out what's actually happened. And of course, there's been a number of arrests we've now heard. What interests me about this is if there have been arrests, there should in fact be trials with juries, and we can perhaps get to the bottom of this, because often what happens is there is nobody to arrest because they're dead.
Well, this chap...
That raises all sorts of questions about what really
this
happened.
This chap, Ahmed Hassan, is not dead, apparently. A couple of interesting things about him is that neighbours of his report multiple police visits over a month. Some believe that the house was being monitored beforehand, and also that he'd been arrested 2 weeks previously and by the police because they thought he was a troublemaker and then let go.
Well, that's right, and hopefully all of this would come out at a trial, because his defence lawyers will be looking into that and saying, well, why wasn't he stopped? What's going on here? Hopefully. But, of course, you can never be sure. I mean, these incidents are incredibly puzzling, and there's always questions.
The main questions here, though, seem to be over whether this actually was a bomb. There are reports of a fireball, but it seems more like some sort of incendiary device.
Well,
anyway,
yes.
Anyway, let's let Tim in on this.
I think today the police have announced that it did actually only partially ignite, and that it was packed with shrapnel. So it would have seemed that it was an attempt at making a bomb. Hopefully, it seems that it was badly made and clearly did not ignite as was expected. It seems an unusual design, but the good result is that nobody got hurt. No one got killed.
The worry here is that it looks like, I mean, we can only say that this is an allegation at this stage, but it looks like this chap, Ahmed Hassan, if it was him behind it, was very much within the purview of the police beforehand.
It certainly seems he was on their radar. As I say, we've got to wait for the trial, obviously, and we've got to see what evidence there is before we will know all of the details. And, of course, it is difficult for the security services. There are several hundred people there constantly monitoring. There are several thousand people being brought to their attention. But the security services, this is not new for them. Let us remember, I was brought up in the days of the IRA. So back then, there were a lot bigger bombs and there were a lot more often.
Also, Martin, this isn't the first time, is it, that the police and security services have been all over this, all over the perpetrators beforehand. In fact, it was the US that leaked it this time. Like previously, and the British security services and Theresa May getting very annoyed with the Americans for saying that this person was known to the police, was known to MI5, the person that they've arrested that still, is this whole thing is an alleged crime by this person. But with all of the pre-general election terror attacks, that is to say the attack at Westminster Bridge, the attack at Manchester, and also the attack at London Bridge, all of the main ringleaders of these three attacks were all known to the security services, MI5 and police beforehand.
Well, the Manchester bomber is the most interesting to my mind, because he was linked with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who've been based in Manchester since the 1980s. And the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group provided most of all the countries in the Middle East, they provided the most volunteers to go to Afghanistan to fight the Russian army.
I mean, is it inevitable that whoever is going to carry out a terror attack in Britain, if it is a terror attack, is going to be known to MI5 police beforehand?
No, I think the question is, we've got to take a step back and ask the relevant questions. The fact is that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group do have a subculture based in Manchester, which began in the 1980s. And we've got a lot of jihadis from all over the world in Britain, because Operation Cyclone in the 1980s, which funneled jihadis from all over the Middle East into Afghanistan via Pakistan, MI6 was the lead agency. And that's why they're all based here, rather than anywhere else.
So
the French police are very well aware.
When the security services infiltrate jihadi groups, there is a question, isn't there, as to whether they're just watching or whether they're actually controlling that group.
Well, the story is that the Western intelligence services, including MI6, set up Al-Qaeda in the 1980s to fight in Afghanistan. And then Al-Qaeda went rogue, and therefore they couldn't control it anymore. They'd given them training, they'd created the infrastructure, but it just went off the park. But of course, exactly the same groups, like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, have been working with British Special Forces and intelligence services very recently in Libya and Syria. And I don't think there's any dispute about that. So the father of the Manchester bomber was arrested by a militia inside Libya, because he was in Libya, I don't know who arrested him, because you've got various factions there now. So he was arrested, but he gave a statement to the media before he was arrested, saying he felt his son was innocent. He was a member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and he felt his son had been set up. And of course, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group had been working very closely with the SAS and others in the last 18 months. And this guy managed to make his bomb. The Manchester bomb did go off. It went off very, very badly and killed a lot of people. It was a professionally made bomb. That's because he's a professional terrorist from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who are our allies against Colonel Gaddafi. Now, I think there are big questions for the security services to answer. And the police, when they're investigating these incidents, need to keep an open mind about the role of security.
Well, the security services do not answer any questions, do they? In fact, we had Charles Shoebridge, the former special branch officer, on this programme a few weeks ago, explaining that there is no press office at MI5 and there's no need for a press office at MI5 because all the Home Affairs correspondents of all the major papers and broadcasters are their press officers.
Well, I mean, obviously this is very murky waters, but I think that if you think about it rationally, Benghazi was the home is the home turf of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which is where the uprising in Libya began, and they were working with British special forces from the get-go, and yet they come back and blow us to bits. Now, what's going on here? I think that relates to and the police need to have an open mind.
Yes, and we need to have journalists that ask questions. Dominic Cacciani, Danny Shaw, and the rest of you at the BBC, especially when it doesn't look like a bomb is a bomb, although, of course, it could be a bomb. There seems to be certain questions. And also, questions need to be asked of the police as to why this guy was then released to then go on and do this. And those questions generally seems to me don't get asked, that we get, not journalism, we just get the reporting of statements by MI5 and by the Metropolitan Police uncritically, which irritates me. Anyway, and one of the spin-offs from this is it certainly seems to have influenced, the Parsons Green attack, the speech by Prime Minister Theresa May at the United Nations General Assembly, where she starts to talk, and we can hear a little clip from that now, about we need to close down certain parts of the internet and the tech giants need to be taking extremist material off, although nobody really seems to know what is extremist and what isn't.
When I think of the hundreds of thousands of victims of terrorism in countries across the world, I think of their friends, their families, their communities, devastated by this evil, and I say enough is enough. So, of course, we must continue to take the fight to these terrorist groups on the battlefield, and the UK will remain at the forefront of this effort while also helping to build the capabilities of our alliances and our partners to better take on this challenge. And we must also step up our efforts as never before to tackle the terrorist use of the internet. For as the threat from terrorists evolves, so must our cooperation. And that is why today, for the first time in the UN, governments and industry through the Global Internet Forum for Counterterrorism will be coming together to do just that. The tech companies have made significant progress on this issue, but we need to go further and faster to reduce the time it takes to remove terrorist content online and to increase significantly their efforts to stop it being uploaded in the first place. This is a major step in reclaiming the internet from those who would use it to do us harm. But ultimately, it is not just the terrorists themselves who we need to defeat. It is the extremist ideologies that fuel them. It is the ideologies that preach hatred, sow division, and undermine our common humanity. We must be far more robust in identifying these ideologies and defeating them across all parts of our societies. As I said in the aftermath of the attack on London Bridge this summer, we have to face the fact that this will require some difficult conversations. We all need to come together to take on this extremism that lives among us and to nurture the common values that must ultimately win out. These are the values of this United Nations. And yet, despite our best efforts, we as nations and as a United Nations have not found the ways or the means to truly take on this threat. And that is why today, as I talk about UN reform, I ask the Secretary General to make this fight against terrorists and the ideologies that drive them a core part of his agenda.
Well, I think we as human beings who use the internet realise the genie is out of the bottle. You can't control the internet. You can obviously ask those people who are major service providers to do as good a job as possible to remove items of extremism. But then again, it will simply go into the dark web. People will go out there and find it.
Now, when people use the word extremist material, I balk at that because I don't know what is extremist and what isn't. I mean, this show, for example,
that's a debate,
we talk about the September the 11th attacks, to a certain extent anyway, being an inside job. In other words, there were people within the United States who were involved in the cover-up of what really happened, and that there was an agenda between the Saudis and the US there. Now, could that be considered extremist to what we're doing effectively is challenging the integrity of government, saying, we don't think you're telling the truth.
Well, I don't agree with that view, but at the same time, I will fight for your right to hold that view and debate that view, and I think that is an issue here. I mean, another example I would give you, what about the Kurdish fighters? So, of course, the West is backing the Kurdish fighters. They're all over Twitter, often putting up photos of battles with ISIS. Are we talking about asking them to remove them? Because, of course, a lot of those fighters are actually technically fighting for what's a designated terrorist organization. And certainly the Turks would like to see their stuff removed. So it is an interesting debate. So I think in one sense, though, it's going down the wrong route. What we've got to do is also ensure the counter-argument is there. What we've got to do is make sure these often vulnerable and isolated people who are signing up to this ridiculous ideology are getting the counter-argument. They realise ISIS are a death cult. They realise, in fact, the people persecuting and killing Muslims is ISIS. We've got to get that message out there. There are some actually really good people out there to help us get that message out. There are programmes like Prevent trying to get that message out, but we've got to get far more in the mainstream. And rather than just try to control, we've also got to get out the counter message and make sure, because I think once people fully understand, they fully see what ISIS and others are about, they will not sign up to them. But it's because all they're seeing is their propaganda. And and I accept that is a problem, but what you can't do is you can't control the internet. It just doesn't work.
Martin, haven't we got a fundamental problem with Theresa May here? Is that she may be saying the right message. We've got to beat these fanatic jihadi death cults. But the thing is, it's coming from her, who a lot of people just simply don't trust.
Well, I think more fundamental than that, if you saw what happened in the Bell-Pottinger meltdown recently, one of the things they were doing was making Al-Qaeda videos for the Americans. They were paid £500 million to make Al-Qaeda videos for the Americans. Now, when you see a video on the internet that says it's an Al-Qaeda video, is that a real Al-Qaeda video or is that a Bell-Pottinger video? That's the first point I'd make. Second point is, of course, there's a report which the Liberal Democrats pushed for about funding of extremist views in Britain. And we've not seen what's in that report, but we pretty much know what's in it, which is that the Saudis are the main funders of extremist speech in Britain. And, of course, our Saudi allies, which we've just supplied with loads and loads of weaponry to carry on killing people in Yemen.
Well, we're not just supplying them with weaponry, we're with RAF personnel to help them.
RAF personnel are out there. Now, of course, I have to say this, Tim, the Syrian general staff, the Iranian general staff, the Russian general staff and the Iraqi general staff believe that ISIS and Al-Qaeda are front organisations for the Western intelligence services and the Saudis. That's what they believe. They may be wrong, but that's a fact. That's a fact that they believe it. And they've got reason to believe that. Because, of course, in Syria and in Libya, that's exactly what's been going on. Western intelligence services, working with the Saudis, working with the Qataris, although the Qataris and the Saudis have now fallen out, have been working with jihadi groups like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group to overthrow Gaddafi and Assad. They failed in Syria, but, of course, you could argue that then we get blowback. You know, we shouldn't really be playing games with these people. But, of course, the suspicion is that it's actually all orchestrated.
Okay, final word to you, Tim, on this. Do you think that people like Twitter, Facebook, Google are doing enough? And does Theresa May have a point?
it's always worth putting pressure on these organisations to try to do more. But in reality, they cannot remove everything instantly. These organisations have a massive presence on the internet. They have hundreds, if not thousands, of people out there. All they do all day long is load up their propaganda. So in reality, you cannot completely shut it down. In fact, the danger of trying to completely shut it down is it moves into the dark web, where it's harder to monitor and impossible to shut down. What we've got to do is ensure the counter argument is out there, that people begin to see these organizations for what they are. And actually, Martin's right. Quite often, in the past, we have worked with these organizations, of course, have then turned against us. And so that is a debate in Syria, where we work with some of these organizations. Will those be our future enemies? It is a constant debate and is a constant problem because, of course, we're not fighting in ideal battlegrounds. It is not a simple battle of ideologies. It is people sometimes believing the same thing on both sides of the battle. Field. Of course, and ironically, we are fighting with Iran in Iraq against ISIS. You know, Iranian special forces are well known to be embedded with Iraqi soldiers calling in US airstrikes. So you've actually got a weird situation where America is actually fighting with Iran against ISIS, and it is a constant circle. And I think we do need to have a bit more thought about when we intervene in these countries. And this all does roll back to some of our original interventions in Iraq, and we're still paying the price for it.
Okay, let's go to something which is a bit more parochial, maybe, well, actually no, but certainly more local, and that is the future of the Port Talbot steel plant. And it's been announced this week that there are now merger plans between ThyssenKrupp and Tata Steel to keep the plant going, at least for a while. Now, there wasn't really... I was surprised at the time that ThyssenKrupp's name wasn't mentioned, because they are, I believe, the first or second biggest steel company in Europe. They're certainly very powerful. They're now... And also, the Thyssen Empire was... I mean, they built Tiger tanks in the Second World War, Thyssen did, as well as Fritz Thyssen being one of the people that was funding the Nazi Party back in the 1920s. Martin, are they the right people to take over Port Talbot?
Well, I think the people in Port Talbot, they just want somebody to keep them in work, and that's obviously their main concern. Whether we should have cleaned out the Nazi sympathisers in West Germany at the end of the war is a big question. We're talking about, you know, who's on our side and who's not on our side a minute ago. Well, those questions go back as far as that, don't they?
It looks as if the final deal is still to be done, though, Tim. What do you think? Do you think is this a good thing? Because it's going to cause maybe a bit of a problem with Brexit, isn't it? With another German company controlling such an important asset here. In a way, it means that something so crucial as steel is not really in British hands anymore.
I mean, well, let's be clear. I mean, Brexit means that our steel costs 14% more to buy abroad, because that's the value of the pound.
Well, we should be making it here, surely.
So we should be making it here. That is a good point. But in reality, the steel market is a worldwide market, and that does mean that British Steel now finds it difficult to compete abroad. So if we have a German company come in and want to help save a British steel manufacturing company, I think that's great. I think it is important that we do not lose all of our manufacturing base. What we're seeing with Brexit is that we are very vulnerable. Our economy is a very service-based economy. So we are very, very vulnerable to the international market, especially the monetary markets, but also those international trade deals. So we do need to make sure we keep our manufacturing base. There are big issues. There's big issues around the pension fund. There are big issues around how can we make sure that we can compete against steel that's made in the third world. But at the same time, high-end steel, So an example would be sort of in Sheffield, when they closed down the factories there that made the razor blades, they soon discovered that, in fact, nobody could actually get the razor blades to a high enough quality as they produced in steel. In Sheffield. So what do they have to do? They have to reopen the factories in Sheffield. So I think the other thing is making sure that we find the gaps in the market. So making sure we're producing the high-end product so that can compete against the more mass-produced product, maybe from China or somewhere else.
Well, I don't know if we can make it as good as the people that built the Tiger tank? I'm not really sure. Do you think it matters?
That's our Talas.
Do you think that
that's our share?
Well, maybe. Do you think it matters that Fritz Thyssen was one of the original funders of the Nazi Party back in the 1920s, and that they were building the tanks that were killing people right across Europe?
But I think we're all aware that quite a few German companies that survived the Second World War had relationships with the Nazi administration, and a choice made then was that to rebuild Germany. And it is an interesting dialogue, because of course the opposite choice was made when the invasion of Iraq happened and they had the purge of the Ba'athists. And what did we see? We immediately saw all of those people organized then in an armed revolt, and which cost thousands of lives. So I think, you know, a decision was made at the end of the Second World War. There really is no point revisiting that now. And what we do have is a successful company who's willing to come in and help try to save British Steel.
And let's hope that they do save the Port Talbot plant. Yes. It'd be marvellous to see if it carries on. Also this week, a bit of a dodgy decision by the Financial Reporting Authority, I think they're called. But anyway, it's about KPMG, the accounting firm that they've been cleared this week for the HBOS scandal, because KPMG did the accounts of HBOS just the year before they collapsed and were found to be basically false accounts that they'd signed off. And they've just been cleared this week, Martin, of any wrongdoing. And what they've effectively said at the Financial Reporting Authority, I think it's called, I'll check that in a second, but is that all of the main accounting firms have made similar sorts of mistakes, and so they shouldn't single out KPMG for any sanctions.
Well, I mean, nobody has really been held to account for the crash in 2008 and everything that follows
from it. The bailout,
yeah. I mean, nobody's been held to account, and the bottom line seems to be that because they were all doing these nefarious things, they can't pick on any individual firm or individual person to be prosecuted. Nobody can be prosecuted.
It's the Financial Reporting Council, and they have just this week dropped the probe into KPMG's audit of HBOS.
Peter Galbraith in the US, who's the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the economist, he's, I think, the University of Texas, and he was saying, unless you prosecute some of the principals involved in the fraud around the 2008 bailout crash, whatever you want to call it, then you're never going to resolve the problem. You really should do that. And that's what happened in the 1980s with the collapse of the savings and loans organisations in the US. Over 1,000 people were sent to prison. Nobody's been sent to prison in Britain or the US or anywhere else for what's happened. And, of course, that means they're still there and they're still doing this stuff. And it's a slap over the wrist. And there's probably going to be another crash, I'm afraid, because we've got a bigger bubble in 2008.
A lot of people saying that there's actually a bit of a cartel here, that the main, like, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Deloitte, and KPMG are in a little cartel, Tim. What do you think?
Well, I think the top four accountancy firms do appear to be protected. They do appear to be unaccountable. And that appearance cannot be good for them. It cannot be good for the financial sector. I think it's a good point. No one has been held to account in reality for the banking collapse. No one has been held to account for banking practices which were clearly risky, and many of us would believe illegal. And an argument that everyone was up to it is not acceptable.
I also like to just quote Paul Moore. Have you ever heard of Paul Moore? He's a whistleblower who was fired for warning about dangerous lending at HBOS. He's called for a total and radical overhaul of the auditing system and argued the watchdog has been captured by the big four accounting firms. The entire system of controlling big corporations, including auditing, accounting and corporate governance, needs a total and radical overhaul, he told the Daily Telegraph. It's a pity we did not do it when we had the burning platform for change after the banking crisis. We don't live in a democracy, we live in a corporatocracy.
Well, obviously I would agree with that. I think the real problem is that we're now, you know, the things we should have done, we haven't done. And it's a bit late now, because we've now got the stock markets around the world are at the highest levels ever. And if you are happy with that, then I suggest you go home and and have a word with yourself, because that is incredibly scary. They shouldn't be at that level. And they're only at that level because of quantitative easing, etc. And anything, just any small thing could turn this into a rout very easily.
KPMG's audit in 2007 turns out to have been a pack of lies, Tim. Does that matter? And I mean, does it that now we're 10 years down the line and nothing's going to happen about it? And if so, it means effectively, I suppose, that if anyone is looking at a business, looking at their accounts, hoping to see anything real there, that they can't guarantee that anymore if it's been audited by one of these big firms.
Well, it's not, of course, just businesses that are auditing, it's government as well. So they audit our accounts at Bristol City Council.
Do KPMG do?
We've certainly had KPMG in the past. I'm trying to remember who currently audits it, but we've had lots of contracts with KPMG in the past. And I'm not particularly picking on KPMG. There's the big four. And there are others as well. There is a problem, I think, actually, within the control of... It's not just their auditing, it's the fact that often the big four are relied on by the Treasury to give them advice, or when it comes to closing tax loopholes. But these are the same companies who then advise the rich on how to get around tax loopholes. And that does seem to me to cause a problem. I mean, constantly, I think the big four themselves are finding themselves on two sides. And that cannot be healthy for them or for our economy. I think, yes, where people made mistakes, they've got to be held to account. And it does seem shocking that no one's been held to account for what happened. Politicians have been held to account. Quite a few lost their seats over this. But it does appear that the large financial firms seem to be protected and untouchable. That's not acceptable.
I think we shall finish with a couple of stories about the cuts. One is from Prime Minister's Questions, which is weird, isn't it? Because there was no Prime Minister's Questions this week. Actually, what happened, Worm, we had our week off. There was a Prime Minister's Questions that we didn't cover. So I found an excerpt from that. But before that, we're also hearing this week from Avon and Somerset Police, whose Chief Constable is saying that the police here are at tipping point over budget cuts. This is pretty serious stuff, Tim, isn't it? If the police are now saying, well, actually, we won't be able to do our job, then that's a green light for criminals.
Well, it's a real problem for communities. I mean, where we have really seen the cuts is in community policing. It is a real difficulty for the police to respond now to priorities of the community. I mean, certainly in my area, community policing has probably been reduced by about half. And often those community police officers are being pulled in to deal with other issues. So it is not their fault. They simply have too many demands upon them.
Andy Marsh is actually saying, singling out also organised crime. He's saying we've got serious problems with organised crime that we just simply cannot deal with. We don't have enough money to.
Well, a lot of it is internet and phone based. And as we know, the prosecutions in them are few and far between. And of course, it's one of the reasons why crime constantly appears to be falling. Because, of course, where the fraud and the theft is occurring is on the internet and phone. And a lot of that is unreported crime.
Okay. Let's hear this little clip from Prime Minister's Questions 2 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago, in fact.
Ruth Smith.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This summer, a third of all parents across the country went without a meal to ensure that they could feed their children during the school holidays. In Stoke-on-Trent, amazing volunteers came together to provide over 10,000 meals for local kids. I'm very proud of my constituents, but I'm disgusted at this government who have done nothing and turned a blind eye. How many kids have to go hungry? How many parents have to go without food before this Prime Minister will do her job and act?
Prime Minister!
Well, I have to say to the Honourable Lady, I recognise, I mean, the issue that she has raised about children, particularly those who are normally able to access free school meals during term time, and the impact this has during the holidays, is a matter that her right honourable friend, the Member for Birkenhead, has, of course, been taking up.
Well, I'm going to fade down Theresa May now because she doesn't actually answer the question. But, Martin, this is pretty serious, isn't it, when parents are having to go without food because the kids, to make sure the kids have got something to eat.
Well, it is. And, of course, and we've had Jacob Rees-Mogg feeling uplifted by the existence of food banks. It's unacceptable. And, of course, it's ordinary people who've paid the price.
I'm going to give you both a chance here.
Financial
one sentence,
mess that we're
how are we
going
to sort out this lack of money being spent? Because it's really crippling people. Tim, you first. One sentence.
Well, the government's got to stop looking to try to cut the people at the bottom And understand that it's about a fair distribution of wealth.
Okay, that was pretty well. I haven't got time for Martin. But anyway, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest Lib Dem Councillor Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Join us after the news.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.